This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. If you could take a blood test to find out about your chances of developing Alzheimer's, would you do it? And if that test revealed that you had a high risk of developing the disease, what would you do? While there is currently no effective treatment or cure for Alzheimer's, scientists are getting closer to identifying the markers and warning signs of the disease. So testing raises some profound ethical issues and questions for patients, their families, and their caregivers, our topic for today's edition of Radio Times. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Dina Davis, Presidential Endowed Chair in Health and Professor of Bioethics at Lehigh University, author of a book called Genetic Dilemmas, Reproductive Technology, Parental Decisions, and Children's Futures. And Dina Davis drove down from Lehigh University. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
I'm really happy to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Jason Karlowish. He's a professor of medicine, medical ethics, and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania. He cares for patients at the Penn Memory Center, also directs the Neurodegenerative Disease Ethics and Policy Program, wrote a book a couple of years ago called Open Wound, The Tragic Obsession of Dr. William Beaumont. And Jason, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure.
Let me begin with a definition, because I want to make sure everyone knows what we're talking about, and I'll toss this to you, Jason. So what is Alzheimer's disease? Do we have a good working definition?
Alzheimer's disease, as we currently understand it, is based on a definition that was laid out in 1984, and it describes a common cause of dementia leading to chronic progressive losses and cognitive impairment that cause someone to be disabled in their ability to do their usual and everyday activities. And so when we talk in conversation about, quote, having Alzheimer's disease or being afraid of having it, what we're talking about is having dementia, being disabled from cognitive problems caused by a particular neurodegenerative disease. That neurodegenerative disease, called Alzheimer's disease, is caused by what we think are accumulations of amyloid plaques and tau tangles in the brain, which are causing nerve cells to die and lead to that those disabling cognitive problems.
So it's sort of one of I guess, a number of diseases related to all those conditions.
Dementia can be caused by a variety of different diseases. Lewy body dementia is one of them, frontal temporal lobar degeneration. But if you look right now in a developed nation like the United States, the most common cause of dementia in older adults is probably Alzheimer's disease pathology, together with some degree of vascular pathology as well.
And the reason we wanted to do the show is that there is this new blood test that could possibly, you know, predict the development of Alzheimer's or some of these related conditions that
exactly.
you just described.
Exactly.
I'm going to go back to you, Jason, then I'll get you in on the conversation, Dina. So what's the significance of this blood test?
So what we're beginning to do now is see the disease before it's clinically present. So what I told you about these 1984 criteria, those are based on someone being sick. You had to be ill to have Alzheimer's disease. You had to be demented. In the 30 years that have followed, scientists have begun to measure the disease in people with it, who have dementia, but also in people who hadn't yet developed dementia. And then what we've obviously begun to see is that you can begin to see markers of the disease present in someone before they're ill, before they're demented. And it's created this idea that one might someday, it's possible that you could have Alzheimer's disease and not be demented.
Right.
We're not ready there with this idea of what's called preclinical Alzheimer's disease, but we're beginning to now roll out studies that are designed to validate whether we can label the disease before someone is ill, because obviously at the same time we have a way to intervene and change the course of the disease. And that's the work that's going on right now. In fact, we just started one of those clinical trials at Penn just this month.
What are some of the ethical issues that you see as related to this blood test, the idea that we could predict, maybe pretty well predict, who might get Alzheimer's?
Right. Well, Alzheimer's disease is extremely prevalent, and it is now catching up with cancer as the disease that Americans fear the most. As I understand it, the average time period between being diagnosed and actually dying is about 10 years. So we're talking about, you know, a pretty devastating disease with a substantial effect on people's family and so on. And when I talk about this with groups, I always start with a kind of a thought experiment that your listeners, you know, might want to do as well.
Sure.
And I say, imagine two people, call them Sam and Connie. And imagine that Sam lives to age 87, and he's cognitively intact and living independently, and then he has a heart attack at 87, and he dies. And then let's imagine Connie, who lives to be 99, and maybe around the time she's 90, she begins to be progressively demented. She spends the last few years of her life unable to recognize her family, unable to feed herself, incontinent, and so on. And then finally dies. So I ask people, which would you rather be? And, you know, 99% of people you ask say, oh, I want to be Sam. I'd be happy to have a heart attack at 87. And, you know, I guess you could fool with it. What if it was 80? What, you know, whatever. But most people, and people will commonly say this in conversation, oh, I hope I die before I'm like, you know, Aunt Minnie or whatever. So my question is, why not, instead of kind of hoping that will happen in a very passive way, why not actually take steps to preemptively make it happen by ending one's life before one gets Alzheimer's? Now, the problem, of course, is you don't know who's going to get it and you don't know when. So I find these predictive biomarkers extremely interesting because as we get better and better at it and, you know, kind of more accurate, then they could be useful for those people who, like me, have those values and want to end our lives before it starts happening.
Well, let's say, I'm not sure what the predictive rate now is, and I realize these tests are sort of being developed even as we speak, but if, let's say, it was, you know, a 55% chance or a 68% chance or a 90% chance,
well,
obviously that changes how one might think about one's future.
You bet. I mean, 55 is probably more or less what we know anyway, right, if you live to be long enough, if you live long enough. But the test that, you know, I think caught your attention a month ago or so, claims to predict cognitive decline, which could be mild cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's, within a five-year period at a 90% accuracy rate.
Right. Which is pretty,
well,
I mean, within the medical world, is that pretty accurate then?
Well, I guess it's accurate depending on what you're going to do with the information, right? I would find it accurate enough to act on, but that's because I'm more worried about getting Alzheimer's than I am about losing some good years. Other people would balance that differently.
And what you're talking about, and I'll get back to you, Jason, but what you're talking about is something that you've described as preemptive suicide. The idea that if within 5 years I knew I was going to get, or I was pretty sure I was going to get Alzheimer's, then while I still have my wits about me, then I might make a decision, or you might make a decision, to end one's life before it begins to deteriorate.
Exactly. And in fact, the average time between the test and those people who showed cognitive impairment was 2 years, even though it was a five-year study.
What do you think about that?
I think the test that came out was published maybe in Nature Medicine about a month or so ago. It was a very interesting set of data. It's going to take a follow-up study to help validate that. It was disappointing that they didn't link the results of the biomarker they had and cognition with biomarkers that we know of Alzheimer's disease, like amyloid or tau. So it was sort of a provocative study, and it's a study that certainly, you know, deserves follow-up. And there are many studies like it ongoing now that are measuring what we think may be biomarkers of Alzheimer's disease in cognitively healthy people and following them over time to see which ones predict. Prediction studies are tough things. You know, we like to say that, you know, all models are wrong. It's just some models are not as wrong as other ones. And so using them for public policy making and when to put them in the clinic is always a big challenge. To me, where the action is in this field is, can we identify a marker that we think stands for the disease, developing Alzheimer's disease, dementia down the road? Can we identify something either by imaging or blood test, which when we then intervene on it with a drug that we think targets that marker, we can change the trajectory of the disease? And the model for that are diseases like cardiovascular disease, where intervening, say, on cholesterol has been shown to change the course of developing cardiovascular endpoints. That model, I think, which relies on experiments, clinical trials, which are starting now, I think is a very powerful model to kind of transform the disease from this category of developing Alzheimer's dementia, which is a fuzzy category, to this idea of a continuum of, if you will, cognitive decline that slowly develops, marked by whatever markers we think drive it, with the opportunity, obviously, to intervene on those markers in the way that, for example, a statin drug and lifestyle habits intervene on on cardiovascular disease.
But let me go back to you, Dina, because as it stands today, my understanding, there's no cure for Alzheimer's, and it doesn't appear that there's any quote-unquote effective treatment for the disease as well. So as it stands today, if you get this, you know, this diagnosis, your prognosis, your future looks pretty bleak.
That's exactly correct. Mm. That's one reason we want the biomarkers, is because you know, we're pretty sure that by the time people show Alzheimer's, it's really too late.
And when we say show Alzheimer's here, what we really mean is, again, that 1984 understanding of have cognitive impairment that's disabling, noticed by family. This other idea of showing Alzheimer's is, I'm going to do a test, which, although you feel fine, maybe some memory complaints, et cetera, this test suggests that the pathology of Alzheimer's is brewing within you and over time will unfold eventually to developing disabling cognitive impairments, and that we're not yet ready there as a field to pick whichever measures those may be and say these should be used in clinical practice to tell people what to expect in the next 10, 15 years.
But go ahead, Dina. I can get back to your comment, yes, if you know now that you either have preclinical Alzheimer's or you're going to get Alzheimer's, depending on your definition here, there isn't a lot we can do about it now medically.
That's right.
Now, what bothers me about this is, you know, people will say, well, therefore, there's no point in sharing this information with the research subjects or the patients because there's nothing you can do about it anyway. And then some people will say, well, there really is, because you could buy long-term care insurance if they don't, you know, try and block you, or you can, you know, talk to your family and so on and so forth. My point is, there is something you can do, which is you can get out while the getting's good. You can decide that you want to end your life before you become incapable of making plans and acting on them. So I find it very frustrating, this constant, well, there's nothing you can do about it, and therefore there is no point sharing that information.
Are you? You're talking about someone killing themselves, committing suicide.
You bet.
And silly question here. Are we allowed to do that?
Well, there's no law against committing suicide. There's a law against helping people. But, you know, physician-assisted suicide, as we have it in Oregon, et cetera, is irrelevant here because it happens within 6 months of your death. And also you have to be competent. And the whole point here is you're not competent. So none of the modalities that we have in place.
The whole point is that you would want to be able to commit suicide before you develop cognitive impairments.
Because you're of your sort of right mind.
And so where things like the Oregon Death with Dignity Act doesn't apply is because there you have to be judged to be terminal, having a life expectancy of 6 months or less. And when you're terminal with Alzheimer's disease, typically, stereotypically, you would lack the ability yourself to say, I'd like to take advantage of the Oregon Death with Dignity Act and yourself take the medication that is given, which is how states that have Death with Dignity Acts require them to be done. Get your biomarker result from research now. I mean, we can talk about that.
Yes, we can. We have to take a very short break. Talking about, you know, a really provocative issue and question, that if you could take a blood test to find out your chances of developing Alzheimer's, would you do it? And our guests are Dina Davis, Presidential Endowed Chair in Health, also Professor of Bioethics at Lehigh University, and Jason Karlowicz, Professor of Medicine, Medical Ethics, and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. His was a genius that would reveal itself early, develop swiftly, and vanish all too soon. Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra present a four-concert Mozart celebration, the final three symphonies, and the three piano concertos of 1785. Mozart tickets online or at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at the Kimmel Center, a Mozart celebration with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Children's books have animals and wizards and heroes, but why aren't there more people of color?
These books are used as ways that kids can make roadmaps for their own lives. And if we don't give them proper roadmaps, where are they going to end up?
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital supports WHYY. Jefferson Orthopedics helps patients with hip, knee, foot, ankle, shoulder, and spinal problems and with sports injuries and offers minimally invasive surgical procedures. Jefferson nurses and physical therapists employ post-operative rehab treatments designed to help patients resume their normal activities and lifestyle. To schedule an appointment or for further details, 1-800-JEFF-NOW or jeffersonhospital.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just to recap, researchers have been making some progress identifying the markers for Alzheimer's, meaning that it could be possible to predict who is at risk for developing the disease. Today, there are no effective treatments and there's no cure for Alzheimer's, but this scientific progress raises a whole host of challenging ethical questions for patients, for their families, and also for the medical community, and that's what we're talking about with our guests, Jason Carlowitz and Dina Davis. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coane. So, Dina, it sounds like you have decided that you would like this information, and you would like to have the authority to make a decision about your future based on this information.
Yeah, that's right. I already, a number of years ago now, did what I could to find out my genetic risk, for example, which turned out to be pretty average, but was in a research study that actually returned that to the subjects.
And your concern is that the medical community, people, caregivers, are not perhaps willing to share this information with patients because it seems like such a terrible diagnosis, and if someone would take their life, then that might raise ethical questions for them?
Well, I'm not sure about caregivers. By the time you have a caregiver, you're probably not in a position to make decisions. But I'm concerned about this constant rhetoric of there's nothing you can do, which suggests that there's no point taking the extra time, effort, and resources involved sharing this with research participants, for example. I'm also concerned, I think there's a real problem here in that if it continues to be the case that suicide is thought of by most researchers as a harm, a disastrous response, which is where the rhetoric mostly is, then I worry that you're starting a new project, you go to your institutional review board, and you don't want to expose your subjects to this quote harm.
So let's
go ahead, Jason.
We're putting, I think, the expression back when we used to use carts and horses is the cart is way before the horse here. Dean is right. You can get genetic testing. You could get it for at least a decade now to test for your APOE gene to predict your risk of Alzheimer's disease, and she in fact has done it, and that's available. You can get that. The biomarkers that we're talking about, which are distinct from genes, one is available, which is amyloid imaging. It's FDA approved. I was on the task force that developed indications for it. The data only substantiated its value in people who are symptomatic with clear measured cognitive impairment, where you want to sort out what's the cause of this dementia. The data simply aren't there to substantiate its value in someone who's cognitively normal. They're just not there. I can't tell a patient like I can what's the meaning of your glucose or whatnot, the results of a biomarker test, who's clinically normal, who has no cognitive impairment. And that's the case with all the biomarkers as we line them up. There are provocative data that suggest as they may help describe how groups behave, and indeed now we have a clinical trial that will look at that issue. But it just simply isn't the case, listeners, that we have biomarker tests that are available for cognitively normal people that will give you valid data to tell you to the year when you will develop Alzheimer's disease dementia. We don't have that. Please don't ask for it. We're not hiding it from you. The research databases aren't eager to give it out because we just don't have those data yet. Will we have those data?
Well,
someday we may.
Okay, someday we may.
I think it will take about 5 years because that's how long it will take for the clinical trials that are using the biomarkers that we're about ready to start now to test whether an anti-amyloid drug affects amyloid deposition and therefore the development of cognitive impairment. That study called the Anti-Amyloid Treatment in Asymptomatic Alzheimer's is starting now. We're study site for it, along with about 60 sites in the nation. And when that study ends in about 4 years, we'll have the data about targeting an amyloid biomarker. And then Dina can get her amyloid test. And based on that result, she can either take the drug or she can go and take a large dose of Seconal. It's her choice.
Right. So,
well,
of course,
obviously, this is a bit of a thought experiment, but no, go ahead, Dina.
Yeah, I mean, of course, Jason's right about the science. But one of the things that we discovered with the Human Genome Project is we want to start the ethical conversation, the philosophical, the legal,
right,
et cetera, before we get to the point where Jason thinks we might be in 5 years. We want to start it now. And my point is, okay, that gives us 5 years to change at least some of the rhetoric so that we no longer see this autonomous choice as a disaster, for example, because I think it could very well influence just the way we've seen in genetics. You know, it could influence how easily information is available to, you know, I don't want to say patients, but to study participants and lay people.
Well, and I'm wondering, too, because knowing people that have cared for parents with Alzheimer's, I mean, the stress and pressure on caregivers is just enormous. And I could imagine, possibly, sometime in the future, that there might be a family where the children are putting a little pressure on mom or dad and saying, you know, maybe we can't afford or we're not in a position to take care of you if something happens, so perhaps you should start thinking about ending your life.
Well, that's absolutely a concern. Another concern, friends of mine who are looking into continuous care communities here in the Philadelphia area just told me that in order to get in, you have to have a doctor write a letter saying that you will be living independently for at least the next 2 years. So now if a predictive test were available, that could be a problem, right? It could be used against you in that way. And we'd have a lot of the problems that, you know, we struggled with when we passed the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, which has some of the parallel issues. But the act didn't, of course, completely stop discrimination.
Yeah. I think I'm sorry.
Well, let me ask you. I mean, is Alzheimer's, is it always a tragic and terrible thing if someone contracts or gets
In general, most diseases are at least unpleasant things, okay, whether that's Alzheimer's disease, cancer, or psoriasis. They're at least unpleasant, and oftentimes they're tragic. And there is something about the diseases of aging which have a particular tragedy to them. They tend to unfold oftentimes like slow-motion train wrecks, or insidiously and quietly, and then in its thunderclap they appear. You fall, you break your hip, you have a stroke, etc. And so Alzheimer's disease is, I think, like many of the diseases of aging, a tough thing to live with. I think it's unique insofar as people often are said to die twice, first in mind and then later in body. And I think a lot of what I'm hearing from Dina is that existential and philosophic and moral angst of the notion of dying first in body and then a few years later in mind. And I think I agree with Dina, we need to start a conversation as a society of how we're going to live with this disease that uniquely causes us die twice, if you will.
And which raises a question about, you know, dignity and choice and well, dignity, I think, is a very powerful one, especially when it comes to something like Alzheimer's.
Yes.
Living with some degree of dignity in a disease that takes so much of that away.
Right. And so in 2011, President Obama signed the National Alzheimer's Project Act. So only just 3 years ago, even as a nation, we have taken an interest in having a national plan. Pennsylvania just issued its state plan just a few months ago in early 2014. The Centers for Disease Control has made Alzheimer's disease one of its priorities as part of the Healthy Brain Initiative. So as a nation, we're beginning now to pay attention as a nation. And in some sense, we could fast forward back in time or fast reverse back in time to when the nation began to think, gee, you know, people are dying of heart attacks. We really ought to start thinking and doing something about it. This would be about 1950s, and so when the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute was put together. That's where we are now in some sense with Alzheimer's disease. And so I think these kind of conversations are important conversations as part of a general national conversation of developing a public policy as well as a medical response and a social response to this disease, namely the issue of how are we going to age successfully with cognitive aging.
Yeah, go ahead, Dina.
Right. I think another thing that's, if not unique, at least an important factor in Alzheimer's, is that once it starts, you lose your ability to direct your life. So I certainly wouldn't like to, you know, get cancer either. But if I did, or if I do, then, you know, and if it's not curable, then I guess I would say, I'm going to live with this until my life is no longer worth living. And then I will refuse various treatments, or I'll avail myself of suicide or whatever. But at every point, presumably, I would still be mentally in control. that doesn't happen. You know, it creeps up on you very insidiously.
Right, and the loss of decisional capacity is also insidious. It's an interesting issue. You know, I work at the Penn Memory Center, and oftentimes overhead I'll hear rapid response calls for patients who are very ill in the medical center. And typically they're at the cancer center, you know, and the diseases are tough, the treatments themselves are tough. And in this disease, as some family members have remarked to me, you know, the treatments themselves are very benign, if at all, in terms of what we have. And you know, you don't have, whereas in cancer, the same opportunities to say no, or if you live in certain states, even to take advantage of a Death with Dignity Act. What's interesting, of course, is amongst people who do take advantage of a Death with Dignity Act and get a prescription, for example, that allowed them into life, only a small fraction actually end up using those prescriptions. There's an interesting control issue at stake. Yeah.
Right. Let me toss something back to you, Dina, though. But what about an advanced directive? I mean, using your example, which is to say, instead of carrying out yourself when you've got some, you know, thinking capacity, lay it out for others to help make a decision in the future.
Well, I mean, I don't think we have data on this, but I'm pretty unconfident. And the reason is that a person with Alzheimer's, certainly, you know, until the very end, can look and, in fact, feel, you know, pretty happy.
Yeah.
Hopefully they're not suffering. There's no reason why they should be in pain. They often aren't aware that they're so cognitively impaired. And they may have a perfectly fine time eating vanilla pudding and watching Sesame Street. And many people have argued that to, say, refuse antibiotics if such a person gets pneumonia, you know, something fairly low level, is unethical because the person no longer has the same values that she had when she wrote the advance directive, values that have to do with dignity and autonomy. Plus, you know, if you imagine you're meeting for the first time a pleasantly demented person who seems to enjoy her surroundings, and you're told, well, you can't treat that person if she gets pneumonia, you may say, well, wait a minute, Mrs. Smith looks like she's getting a lot of value out of her life. How can I possibly not treat my patient? You didn't know Mrs. Smith 20 years ago when she read that advance directive. So I'm pretty suspicious that those are going to be tremendously helpful.
Yeah,
what do you
I mean,
think,
I think
Jason?
I think the data around advance directives show a very interesting finding. We've shown this in one study we did, another one done a decade or so earlier showed the same result, namely that people will tell you what they do or don't want in the future. I do or I don't want dialysis if my kidneys failed. But a substantial number of them, if you ask them, will say, and I will give my surrogate substantial leeway over that choice. In other words, they could do the exact opposite of what I just told you. And so once you start to look at people's sort of what do you want in the future, what you find is they start to want to put a lot of leeway around what they want in the future, and some don't. You know, it's possible some people may craft very precise advance directives with very clear conditions around leeway and whatnot that could guide people. But then we get to a basic dignitary issue of, it would be awfully tough in the setting of patients who are enjoying an apparent hedonic pleasure in their life to suddenly enact a directive written 10 years earlier that would require you to end their life then. And
it wouldn't be ending their life. It would be, I mean, you wouldn't be putting a pillow over their head. You would be not giving them antibiotics if they got pneumonia or something like that.
I was Dina's correct. I was reading into it, for example, enacting even a death with dignity type intervention at that point.
Withholding treatment if someone.
Well, no, I was reading beyond that and saying even giving someone, say, you know, an organ and whatnot where you can have a lethal dose. But Dina's case was not pursuing a treatment that seemed necessary, such as a treatment for pneumonia. So I think advanced directives are going to be seemingly attractive, but I think ultimately probably a very difficult way to try to plan for this future.
We have an email from Jeff, and this is all speculative, folks, just so you know, just to underscore what we've been talking about. He wanted to know, if you take a test, does this become part of your medical record?
This is a very good question. So if the tests that we have right now for biomarkers in Alzheimer's disease, particularly the testing that is done with cognitively normal individuals, and we at the Penn Memory Center have lots of people who have these tests, are all part of a research record. They are not part of your clinical record. And so therefore, when someone asks to see your medical record, they're not visible. They're not there. And in the clinical trials we have coming up, we're very careful about making sure that the amyloid imaging results are, although done in a clinical research facility along with other clinical exams, that that imaging result is not present in the medical record. It's only in the research record.
You want to add to that, Dina?
Well, no, that's exactly right. But again, that's something to think about as we move forward. For example, in this REVEAL study in which people were given some useful information about their genetic risk for Alzheimer's, the one clear difference it made was that people at greater risk were more likely to buy long-term care insurance. That makes perfect sense, but not if you are the CEO of a long-term care insurance company.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, adverse selection. It's exactly what they don't want. So, you know, when this information becomes more useful than it is at present, then we'll have some competing agenda here. And, for example, the protections of, again, using that parallel with genetic information, they don't protect people, who, and maybe they shouldn't protect people who want life insurance, disability insurance. Right. They protect health insurance.
What about things like false positives? I mean, those things happen.
Well, that will always be an issue with, with testing. And
where you get the diagnosis, like, but you don't really...
And false negatives.
Yeah. And false negatives
like,
as well.
Like I said, all models are false. All models are false. It's just some are not as false as others, you know, or incorrect. Which is why, again, you know, like the study that appeared and got a lot of media attention a month ago, and for good reason... the amount of data and the kind of data you need to say that a test is good as a predictive test is an extremely high bar, and we're not ready there for tests for Alzheimer's disease dementia in cognitively normal people. We are not ready there. We are ready for those tests in people who have dementia, who I diagnose as clearly impaired, clearly disabled, and the question is what's causing this person to be disabled from cognitive problems. Their tests like amyloid imaging, if I could get Medicare to pay for it, could be are very useful. But bring me someone who, say, appears on Radio Times as a guest and then bikes back to university and say, give this man a biomarker test for Alzheimer's disease because it will give you clinically useful data. The answer is I don't have that test. There is one research study that we're doing where if he was between 65 and 75, he could get that test and based on that result potentially be in a clinical trial to test an anti-amyloid drug, which 5 years from now could transform Alzheimer's into a diagnosis based on your amyloid test result. But that's a future, not a present.
Yeah, but what I hear from you, Dina, is that, yes, this all may be in the future, but let's do some thinking, some planning as we think about what
we
want.
I'm 67. That future, you know, when I'm, you know, closer, then that future will be here.
You could be in the A4 study.
That's right.
But do you think, I mean, we're almost up in a break here, but I'd be curious about your response to this idea that you have of kind of preemptive suicide.
And you're interested in?
In just what's been the response to that?
Oh, I see. Well, it's been interesting. There appears to be a kind of gap. As I said, you know, almost everyone, if you said, which would you rather be, almost everyone would choose the heart attack. But if you then say, well, give yourself a heart attack, in essence, then people kind of back away because there's a taboo. But, you know, there used to be a big taboo about birth control. People would say, oh, God, I'd love to have only 3 kids. And I think it's time to start breaking the taboo about suicide.
We're going to pick up on that very provocative statement by our guest, Dina Davis, also talking with Jason Karlowish. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Widener University School of Law. A Juris Doctor degree from Widener Law is designed to help you to start your legal career with confidence. Both campuses in Wilmington, Delaware, and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania offer flexible scheduling, with full and part-time classes allowing you to earn your Juris Doctor degree on your time. Specialized certificate programs are also offered to help you develop expertise in specific fields of law. More information at WidenerULaw.com. That's WidenerULaw.com.
Humor unites us. Studies say that laughter can lengthen our lives, sharpen our cognition, and release tension. But what makes us laugh? I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll talk with author and comedian Bob Saget and cognitive scientist Scott Weems about how and why we laugh. today at noon here on WHYY FM.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents John Batiste and Stay Human Friday, April 25th at Perelman Theater. Artistic Director-at-Large of the National Jazz Museum in Harlem, Batiste has ignited the New York jazz scene with his interactive live performances. Batiste and his musical collective Stay Human create music that connects with the next generation while staying true to the roots of jazz. Tickets for John Batiste and Stay Human available at KimmelCenter.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing with a couple of questions for you. If you could have a blood test to find out your chances for developing Alzheimer's, would you have that test? And if that test revealed that you would be diagnosed with the disease in just a few years, what would you do? Would you even consider ending your life before becoming incapable of making that decision about the care that you receive? And that's something that Dina Davis has written about. She's Presidential Endowed Chair in Health, also Professor of Bioethics at Lehigh University, author of a book called Genetic Dilemmas, Reproductive Technology, Parental Decisions, and Children's Futures. Also with us, Jason Karlowish, Professor of Medicine, Medical Ethics, and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. He cares for patients at the Penn Memory Center, also directs the Neurodegenerative Disease Ethics and Policy Program, wrote a book a couple of years ago called Open Wound. Let me get some callers in. We have Karen from Elkins Park joining us on Radio Times. And Karen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I just wanted to add to the conversation, both my grandmother and my father died from Alzheimer's. And as a person who lived with the fear of perhaps this is something that's going to happen to me. But my siblings, when my dad died, we sort of jokingly talked about a suicide pact.
Wow.
Half joking, half not.
Yep.
But I would absolutely never get the blood test. I already live with the fear of, this could be coming for me. And if I were to get a blood test that would even just say I had 45% of that potential and there's nothing to do about it, what would I do with that information besides worry even more?
Right. And
to me, it seems like a totally no-win situation.
Fair enough. Yeah, for you, I understand that.
Yeah, and I think if you went out and polled a group of, and these polls have been done, very well done, population-weighted samples, you find a substantial chunk of people echo what the caller said, and a substantial another chunk of people say the opposite and say, I'd like to know the information. Mm-hmm. I think that's the way people are. I mean, James Wilson had his human genome sequence, one of the discoverers of the human genome. He chose not to learn his APOE gene, a risk gene for Alzheimer's disease. Craig Venter, a venture capitalist, biotech entrepreneur, publicly said, I had my whole genome sequence, one of the first to have it. And he learned his APOE genotype, learned he was an E4 carrier, and now does some things to reduce his risk. So right. Two very bright guys divided very differently on it. I think for the caller, thinking and responding as a physician, I would want to be able to offer you a test that could tell you about your future of Alzheimer's disease if I could also offer you, linked with it, an intervention to reduce that risk. And I think that's the future we want to get to and think about here.
Do you like the idea of choice, though? I mean, is that one of the things, Dina, that you're in favor of? That Karen can choose not to for all her own personal reasons.
Oh, absolutely. I'm always in favor of choice. I mean, Karen might also think about how great she'd feel if the test showed that her chances were actually pretty low, right? And a relief from a concern that she now has. But yeah, I'm absolutely about choice. And there are those of us who would, for whom autonomy and control are extremely important values.
Now, I do think under our healthcare system at large, if all we have to offer is a test that is predictive of developing cognitive decline and it's not linked to other benefits beyond that, I think in the hierarchy of what are we going to pay for heart disease, cancer, falls, gait disorder, incontinence, that test is on a very low hierarchy for reimbursement.
Yeah, that's one of the things that worries me is, it might be on a low hierarchy for reimbursement, and if it didn't have, as it probably does, important research benefits, it might be on a low hierarchy for development as well. But that's because the rhetoric casts it as there's nothing we can do, and my point is that's not true.
Mm. I think from a public policy perspective, I'm happy it's on a low priority. I want to make sure sick patients have the resources we need to take care of them before we start giving people our resources so they can plan for a future when the data are good about various scales I can give you now that can tell you about your risk of developing cognitive impairment independent of a blood test that I have to charge to Medicare.
We have an email from Beth. I'll put this to you, Dina. Is suicide the only possible option to control your destiny?
Well, you know, we might shoot that to Jason and ask him how confident he is in the various modalities that can be offered now. But I think he's going to tell us he's not at this point. That there isn't a whole heck of a lot you can do.
Well, yeah, I know. It's interesting. There's no question about 2010, an NIH consensus conference was formed to say, what do we know that can reduce the risk / prevent the development of cognitive impairment, Alzheimer's? Big group of smart people all got together, walked away, and said there's inconclusive evidence. Having said that, many people then read the report and were furious because they said if you look at the data around certain healthy lifestyles, consistently across epidemiologic studies, you see that a heart-healthy diet and heart-healthy behavior reduce the chances of developing cognitive impairment down the road and are good in and of themselves, having been shown to be beneficial for your heart. Same thing with social engagement, same thing with cognitive engagement. And for some of these things, we'll never probably get a randomized trial to show that social engagement is good. But I think we as a society, in terms of wanting our older adults and near older adults such as myself to flourish, we should want to spend our resources to organize our communities and give people options that are heart healthy, that are socially engaging, that are cognitively engaging.
But I would also think, you know, the idea of planning ahead. I mean, we don't often have that opportunity of planning ahead and trying to figure out, well, how am I going to live the next 5 years?
Well, sure. I mean, if I had Alzheimer's, I'd rather have money than not. I would rather have made some plans than not. And there are some other things. When my father was 85, he refused an operation to fix an aneurysm that he had. And, you know, he had various reasons for that. And he died of that aneurysm when he was 87. And, you know, the chances are, I suppose, roughly 50-50 that if he hadn't done that and were still alive, that he would now have Alzheimer's. So, you know, maybe he factored that into his decision.
But what you're saying, what I hear you both saying, is that the longer we live, the greater the chance that we will have, if not Alzheimer's,
you can go online right now and find dementia risk curves where, you know, enter your age, your gender, your APOE type, some social habits, and they'll give you back a number. How credible that risk calculator is in the eyes of the beholder, but peer-reviewed literature reports these. So right now you can find out, as like an insurer, you know, given those factors, what's your chance of developing dementia down the road? That's out there. So, you know, the blood test will, like this, down the road may add further specificity, but you can get that information now.
Let me get Kate from Narberth to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Kate, go ahead. You are on the air. Yes, go ahead, Kate.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome,
Marty. I'm kind of curious about this disease that you all are talking about in terms of Alzheimer's, that it's something that people would think is worse than death. And particularly because my experience with my own parents, my father died a few years ago and probably had Alzheimer's, but he knew all of us right up until his death. My mother has dementia. She's in assisted living. The neurologist who sees once a year asked her if she can name the paperclip he's holding in his hand. He said the last 2 years that she does not deteriorate at the rate he expected. She's, you know, she has poor memory, and she won't be able to tell you what day it is, but she's a very happy person. And I'm trying to understand what you all are talking about that people would not want to live through, and what the difference is between that and my mother, whose record probably says she has Alzheimer's.
Yeah, Kate, hold on. Let me first toss it first to you, Dean, and then to you, Jason.
Right. Well, I think it's a question of values and a question of choice. I'm delighted that your mother's having a good experience, and it sounds like in your family, this is, you know, not as good as if she didn't have dementia, but it's not a bad way to go. Other people would be absolutely appalled at the thought that they couldn't write their own checks or live independently or drive themselves to the grocery store.
Recognizing
the paperclip.
Is it what they think other people will think of them, or do they really believe that they'll be miserable?
So I think, Kate, you're getting a good point, and there is quality of life in Alzheimer's disease. I think you can see it in patients who have the disease who tell you that they're happy and satisfied with their life. But you can also find patients who tell you they're not happy and not satisfied.
Certainly.
But then there's also this issue that I think Dean is getting at, which is the dread of developing it. But of course, then it says, well, what is the it that we're worried about developing? Mm. Alzheimer's disease dementia in the mild stage, the moderate stage, the severe stage, the terminal stage. You know, it's a 10-year period of decline, and I think many of us, while we would never want to have it at all, would if you sort of were with someone in the mild stage, you know, they're happy, it's not that bad. The other issue I hear you talking about, which is something that we need to have a conversation about as a society, is the stigma attached to the disease and its label. And in brief, our group did a study on that, and one of the things we found was that a lot of the stigma around the label is around the fear of the future. It's not the actual label, and it's not the current disability, it's the fear of the future.
Kate, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Right. Tina, it looks like you want to add something.
Yeah, I was interested in Kate saying, well, but you might not be miserable. I don't think miserable for me is the issue. When Iris Murdoch died of Alzheimer's, her husband, her widow, wrote a book in which, among other things, he talked about how much she enjoyed watching Teletubbies. And this was among the most brilliant philosophers and novelists, you know, of our century. And I hate the fact that I now know that she spent her last years enjoying Teletubbies. I think that's a terrible blow to her dignity. I guess you can call that stigma, but she was happy.
Well, I was going to say, but was she happy? I mean,
she was.
Her
husband, John, lays out very clearly she's happy. I guess I'm a geriatrician. It is tragic to see Iris Murdoch watching the Teletubbies, but on the other hand, I see frailty as part of the human condition. It's something that, while I don't welcome it or want to myself experience it, I guess I have a view of it that sees it like the winter. It's something that does happen.
Kate, I appreciate the call. Let me see what Nick from Lancaster has to say. Hi, Nick. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Yes, go ahead, Nick.
Great. Hi, my name is Nick. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm going to participate in this fascinating discussion. I was calling to make the point, we've sort of done great success in treating diseases like cardiovascular disease, as one of your panelists talked about earlier, and, you know, striving cancer. And as, I think, a direct consequence, you know, we are moral beings, and the final common pathway for all of us is death. And currently the burden has been shifted from those diseases to things like Alzheimer's, dementia, and that's why those deaths are skyrocketing. When are we, as a society, going to stop trying to treat the next disease we encounter as we age and more focus on transitioning to aging gracefully and treating end-of-life care rather than aggressively treating the next measure?
Nick, I'm going to toss that to Jason, and then I want to hear from Dina.
Nick, it's a great question. Back when the Affordable Care Act was being put together, one of the modest proposals was to allow primary care doctors to have a brief conversation with their patients about planning for the future. A former vice presidential candidate and governor from Alaska said that death panels had got knocked out, and so we don't even allow primary care doctors to have a simple conversation with their patients, to plan for the future because we were afraid as a society that, quote, might encourage death panels. So, Nick, I hear you, man, and I wish we could open up these conversations.
Yeah, well, as I understand that we allow it. We just are not going to compensate.
Pay for it, right.
And, well, and we don't talk about it.
You just won't get compensated.
You can talk about it, but I can tell you right now, one way that makes sure that a clinical event encounter, something happens in the clinical setting, is to reimburse it. And the Affordable Care Act was wanting to reimburse physicians to talk to their patients about advanced care planning. That got knocked out as death panels. So Nick's making a very good point that we need to structure our healthcare, our medical system, to be a healthcare system to let people plan for their future and plan for good health.
Nick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. As he was talking, I scribbled down cure for aging. I mean, you know, there is no cure for aging.
Right. And after all, it is in some way medical science that got us into this fix, right? Well, I mean, we don't die of cholera and TB and all those kinds of things, useful things perhaps, that we used to die of in the first world.
You mean that? Useful things?
Well, I was saying that ironically, but on the other hand, you know, it's because of that that we're now living into our 80s and 90s, and now we are, you know, sitting ducks for things like Alzheimer's that were not that common when people died in their 60s.
The typical patient I see at the memory center is someone who was diagnosed with and treated for their cardiovascular disease, breast cancer, prostate cancer, colon cancer, survived it, and here they are. Ronald Reagan, late in his second term, diagnosed with colon cancer. It was treated, et cetera. And, of course, now we know what he did die of. I think the lesson is that we need to shift from a system that is about medical care to a system that's about health care. And I'm cautiously optimistic under what the Affordable Care Act lays out in terms of creating medical homes, et cetera, that we can begin to think in that way.
I'm going to quote Jean only because we don't have time to get her on the air. This is Jean from Yardley. I'm looking at my computer. She's interested in talking about her experience as a long-term caregiver for her father. When his brain changed, she learned a lot from him. And I think she's discouraged by the idea of I guess, preemptive suicide, Dina, to use your words. For her, it was a meaningful experience. Jean, I hope I summarized that correctly.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. Whether her father, you know, might have thought the same thing, we don't know. But perhaps. You know, there are families with different values. In my family, that has not been the case.
Mm. Do you see, and you're younger than the two of us here, Jason, do you see that we will make progress so that we can, if there is a diagnosis, that there will be some kind of a treatment? I'm not even going to talk about cure yet, but some kind of a treatment to
We are delay. Very good right now at diagnosing the disease in people who are sick, who are demented. I think that the future, I do think that it is reasonable to say that we will see a future where there will be a certain class of the disease, category of the disease, diagnosed on the basis of a biological marker, markers of some kind that are responsive to a treatment that will change the trajectory of decline. I think that that is a viable future within the next 5 to 10 years.
And does treatment change anything for you?
Sure.
If this were a treatable disease, would we be having this
Absolutely. We'd be having this conversation about the next disease. I'm not even sure what that next disease might be.
Actually, the next conversation we'll be having is when we do discover that treatment that is used in individuals who are otherwise asymptomatic, but on the basis of a test, we think they have a higher risk.
Right.
The conversation will be, when do you stop the treatment?
Okay. And it just keeps on going and going. Well, my thanks to both of you. Dina Davis, thank you for coming down from Lehigh to join us on Radio Times. And she is a Presidential Endowed Chair in Health, also Professor of Bioethics at Lehigh University, author of Genetic Dilemmas, Reproductive Technology, Parental Decisions, and Children's Futures. Jason Karlowicz, Professor of Medicine, Medical Ethics, and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania, cares for patients at the Penn Memory Center, and he also directs the Neurodegenerative Disease Ethics and Policy Program. Very busy guests that we have in this hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant, Sophie Reed, helping us out in the first hour of Radio Times today. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.